Hi, Simon Hill here. Enjoy our podcast? If you'd like to help us keep delivering the sort of quality football chat you want, then you can show your support by making a donation. Big or small, however much you can afford, we appreciate all your help, and every cent will be ploughed back into improving production. Thanks in advance from all of us at Shim, Spider, and so much more.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Corner kick. Celtic couldn't handle Wood at the set piece. It's a brilliant header. And Cahill goes to Spinsengler. What about that? What about that? Here's Aloisi for a place in the World Cup. He's scored.
You're with Shim, Spider, and so much more. Take it away, fellas.
Yes, hello again. Episode 13 coming your way of Shim, Spider, and so much more. And we're in a different location, as you can see this week. The pod goes on the road, well, to my house to be more exact, the wonders of Zoom. Another fascinating week in the world of football in Australia. The revised 11 principles, which forms the subject of Simon Says this week. Lucas Neal returns out of the wilderness. Tony Gustafsson is the man to lead the Matildas over the next crucial few years leading into a home World Cup. And while lower tier clubs struggle to stay alive in England, Sheffield United pay £23.5 million for a striker who's yet to play a single minute in the Premier League. Wow. Joining me to offer their expert opinions, Zeljko Kalat, sponsored by Coffee in Greece, and Craig Moore, sponsored by No Doze in Scotland. How are you, boys?
Good morning, Kalimera, everybody. It's ridiculous. Even the guy down at reception said to me, "What's going on? You're an hour early." I said, "Yeah, the clock's changed in Australia."
Mate, and luckily I'll give you the nod on the clock changing, Spider, or we would start without you.
Mate, you've done well, Big Chops, because, mate, I was no chance of turning up at the right time.
Yeah.
Well, we're pleased to have you both on board. Spider, we got a Twitter question for you to kick things off from Brett Griffo. He says, as the A-League's 13th franchise, who's
Zanti? That's not bad. I don't mind that one. I've seen that one on Twitter somewhere. I said, that's not bad. We had a little giggle about that when I shared that with the boys here.
Good stuff. Maury, how's the agency business going? Busy time for you, I imagine, with the end of the European transfer window on Monday.
Yeah, no, it is very, very busy, Simon. Look, hard to get involved in business. But, you know, I'm enjoying it, networking, and I'm sure there'll be a lot of positive movements, maybe not this window, but preparation for the next one.
Okie dokie. Let's get into it then with a slightly altered version this week of Simon Says.
Simon Says.
So this week saw the release of the second and final iteration of FFA's 11 principles, the plan to take the game of football forward here in Australia. At 74 pages, it is a bit slimmer than the 109-page whole of football plan tome, which was released in 2015, which we assume is now utterly redundant. And it follows on, of course, from an extensive consultation process. Now, like its predecessor, there's a lot to absorb. So in keeping with the 11 theme, we've broken it down into 11 key points, so you don't have to, and we'll give our views on each. So here we go. Point one, firstly, the principles state that FFA is about to move away from its College Street base in Sydney, potentially, we guess, to a national home of football, part of a plan to get football homes in each state, and the home in the Matildas, presumably the one planned in Victoria. My take, brilliant. It's time the game had its own homes, and the fact that FFA has terminated its lease suggests to me that a plan is in place. Maybe this can house the much talked about museum, which we'll come on to later. The game does seem to be finally getting its act together in terms of fighting for funding for these projects, helped, of course, by landing the FIFA Women's World Cup in 2023. Spider, what's your view on that?
Look, I agree with you. I think it's about time. It's just a matter of where we go to. Obviously, I'm thinking it's going to stay in Sydney somewhere. It'll come down to costs and funding. Maybe Parklea might host it. They might build something else at Parklea. They've got a great setup down there. So who knows, but it's a great idea. Looking forward to seeing where FFA go to.
Long way to go if there's going to be a football museum there. It's not exactly in the heart of the city, but we shall see. Point two, it plans to continue to unbundle the A-League from FFA control, with the clubs, of course, being given responsibility for negotiating the CBA and selling the commercial properties of the professional leagues. It intends to unify the football calendar with Asia, and that, of course, is the continuation of the push towards a winter A-League and W League. Now, my take on this is yet another deadline has passed on independence. October the 1st was mooted as the day the clubs and FFA were finally going to separate. Once again, it hasn't happened. Goodness knows how many deadlines we've missed over the last couple of years. I do hear an in-principle non-binding agreement has been signed. Hey, it's only 2018 since we first started talking about all this. The glacial pace for me is very frustrating, especially with the Fox deal now having less than 10 months to run. On the unification of the calendar, yep, a tick from me. I think winter is worth a try and the football is better, though, of course, we know the potential problems as well. Maury, what's your take?
Yeah, look, my take, well, Simon, first and foremost, I hope that this is we have better results and kind of don't waste our money like we did on the whole of football. But in terms of alignment, for me, that's always been key in Australia. I think that's a non-negotiable. And I believe winter, where the professional game meets the majority of the game in Australia, I think is a fantastic fit. Clubs wanted control. So in terms of independence, they need to get their act together quickly. Pleasing to hear that the CBA is a lot closer, because that's protection for all in the game, I believe. Just one point I put down, I'll mark down for that, was with the independent structure and setup, I would really like to see an independent panel that not necessarily is the club people, Simon, that are driving this, because I just feel that you need that independence. People that are there to make decisions for the best interest of the game. So hopefully that's something that will be put in place also to help guide the game in a positive way moving forward.
Yeah, some structure needs to be put in place sooner rather than later, you would imagine, if the A-League is going to go independent. Point three, the A-League is to expand to 16 teams over the next two phases, and they're going to reintroduce the marquee player concept. I don't know if it ever actually went away. It wants to establish an internal transfer market, which we've heard a lot about, and a clearinghouse to facilitate that, and it also wants more minutes for young players. My take, a 16-team A-League, yep, bring it on. Just two questions. When are these next phases taking place? And crucially, what is the process? More minutes for kids, fine. I applaud the upping of the age limit from under 20 to under 23 for A-League players in their NPL teams. But what does it mean for the A-League? Does that mean quotas of young players? On the transfer market, I think that's long overdue and, of course, should help with the Australian football economy in particular. Spider, your take?
Yeah, look, it all sounds great. I think it's quite clear that we're all speaking the same language now about the younger players getting an opportunity. So maybe it does mean three players in the first 11 under 23 level or playing in the NPL. I think now it's even more important that the second division once again gets a push. So whether the other four teams come from the second division. But look, the directions are right. We're starting to speak the same languages. The timelines are important. When is this going to happen? Obviously, it's not going to happen in 2021. But as soon as 2022, that would be fantastic. Because I really don't think it's that hard to put together.
Okay, point four. It wants the W League to become one of the top five global leagues and to establish a women's football department to lead a national strategy and implement a 10-year women's football business plan. Okay, great. How to attract top players here in the face of huge competition from the US and increasingly from Europe? I guess that comes down to money, which we do not have. And also the W League, if it's going to be one of the top five global leagues, surely needs to expand both in terms of size and the number of fixtures it plays. When and how is that going to happen? Those are my two big questions, Maurik.
Yeah, no, look, a football department and a plan for women's football is crucial. I hope that in terms, because I believe we've got a golden generation of girls currently, and hopefully there's been some learning of how football in Australia stood still with the men's golden generation in terms of that ongoing development. So hopefully that can be rectified. Personally, I believe for us to be a top five league throughout the world, I think is unrealistic. Money dictates that. We've touched on the league, Simon, that are developing throughout the world that are throwing far more dollars at it than what in Australia we will be able to. I think realistically, we should focus on continuing to be a development league.
Okay, point five. It intends to adopt a one football governance framework, essentially one strategy across the nation, with the document pointing out the duplication in the various states at administrative, workforce and financial levels. It says an estimated $164 million is currently levied upon players and parents annually. Of that, $108 million remains with clubs, $23 million with associations, $24 million with member feds, who also receive a $6 million distribution from FFA, taking that up to $30 million. FFA retains just $9 million, with $6 million of that redistributed, which is extraordinary. And FFA reckons that by transitioning towards this one football model, it can save $20 million in operational efficiencies. My take, I think it's time this happened. One country, one game, one plan, a unitary model with state advisory boards for me. FFA sets policy, member feds carry it out. No longer should the tail wag the dog, but good luck getting turkeys to vote for Christmas. I reckon that's going to require government intervention. Let's hope FIFA doesn't notice. Spider.
Yeah, look, that's look, it sounds great. The idea is great. We've had this discussion, I think, in previous years. It hasn't eventuated. I really would love to see this happen. I think a lot of people, football people out there, would like to see this happen. And then the money gets distributed in the right ways. I have my doubts. I have my doubts. It sounds great, but I really do have my doubts.
Point six, as a knock-on from that, it wants more affordable football for kids and is considering financial controls on player payments at NPL level. And it also wants to review the role of private academies. I've got no issue with any of those proposals, though I do remember Han Berger saying many years ago he wanted a licensing scheme for private academies and it never, ever happened. I just wonder if it's just too difficult to regulate, maybe. Maury?
Yeah, no, I don't think so. I actually think that Han Berger was on the right track back then. It's something that I've pushed also with the FFA in regards to the reason why we have these private academies, Simon, is because of the lack of direction that has been or that previously hasn't been in place. There's a lot of good academies out there doing the right things that are offering the extra training. I believe that we need to set criteria to have accreditation. Therefore, we get far more information coming back into the organisation on these players and how they're developing.
Okay, point seven. It wants to transition the FFA Cup into a group stage in the early rounds, adopt a women's FFA Cup, and for the cup final to have its own identity, maybe it's the last game of the season. It's also considering renaming or rebranding the A and W leagues. Now, personally, I applaud the ideas around the FFA Cup. It will give NPL clubs more games against A-League opposition and, of course, you know, more content to sell as well. The only downside, I suppose, is that lack of a one-off edge to the games in the early stages that we see at the moment. A standalone cup final, yes, please. For me, it should be in Canberra, the national capital for the final, to create some traditions. Play an Australian, New Zealand men's and women's international there that weekend as well. Make it a real festival of football to close the season. In terms of rebranding the A-League and W-League, why? and to what, Spider?
Yeah, look, I love the idea of the FFA Cup being a one-off match, because the reality is the NPL clubs, they probably do have a chance in one match. I think the more games you play, the A-League clubs get the advantage. But that might get closer if we get 16 teams, if we get a second division. That's a different story. I understand what they mean by group stages, more games for everyone, which is, again, fantastic. More crowds coming in, more profits for the clubs. Changing the A-League and the W-League, yeah, I don't know. I don't know where that's come from. Sponsorship, maybe it could be called whoever sponsors the league. I don't know. But obviously the FFA Cup thing, I'm a bit like you. I think the one-off games are more exciting. Having a home for the final of the FFA Cup, I like that idea as well, Simon. Canberra, fantastic. Why not?
Yeah.
Okay, point eight. It wants to introduce a digital football hub to enhance commercial opportunities for the game, perhaps via the construction of a special purpose vehicle to help that commercialisation process and as a vehicle for the OTT platform. Again, I think this is something that's overdue and a portal to the game's future with linear and pay TV seemingly not much interested at the moment. It's incumbent that this is set up ASAP. Special purpose vehicle is interesting, presumably some sort of investment partner. Without it, the hub and the OTT platform probably doesn't happen. But again, there's not that much detail about this, Maury.
No, and this kind of goes back to point five, I think, Simon, in terms of you know, coming together as one and the savings that we know that have been put out there in terms of administration. So if we can potentially save 20 million through administration and ploughing through with strong leadership, the member federations, then there's 20 million that could go to investing in the game with a third party ownership. That is a good starting point to come up with this digital content, this hub, this one platform that really is going to be essential to drive our game forward. So is it possible? Yes, I believe it is, but we need to make tough decisions and work through these member federations sooner rather than later.
Okay, point nine. It plans to continue the development of a national second division framework, which it says should ensure connection to the NPL via sporting merit. It wants to consider how to access these competitions. And again, it offers up the Mexico example of promotion being based upon a points per game basis over 3 years. And a national club licensing framework will be established to help that process. I have to say, I'm disappointed there's not a more formal commitment to a Division 2. And I did also have to smile at the irony of the insistence that any Division 2 needs to connect to the NPL via sporting merit. I hope the A-League's going to abide by that principle as well. As to the Mexico example, not for me. I think once promotion and relegation is established, it should be one up, one down, or two up, two down every season. Everything else, Spider, in my opinion, is just a little bit too open to manipulation.
Yeah, I think so as well. I think the main principle is to get the NPL or the second division up and running. Get these clubs that want to be a part of it, get it up and running. The sooner we get it up and running, the sooner we'll have relegation and promotion, the sooner we will have some sort of normality to football. At the moment, we have a league that has no relegations. So that news needs to happen quickly. I totally agree with you. I mean, no manipulation. Get there, put the teams in, and off we go.
Okay, point 10. It plans a football museum to celebrate the game's history. Obviously about time too, but that can't be, in my opinion, the start and finish of celebrating the story of the game. A lot of stories need to be told. Perhaps the digital hub is a potential space for that. And I also hope that by celebrating history, in inverted commas, we do also remember that it's not just about the NSL, but the history of a game that goes all the way back to the 1870s in this country. We actually set up a heritage committee for that, of which, of course, I should state I am a member. We haven't met since COVID started in March, so I don't know what's going on with that at the moment. Maury, what's your take on the museum?
Mate, I agree with you here, Simon. I think a National Football Museum is a step in the right direction. We need to embrace the game's history. And like you, I'd like to see that go back to you know, how the game started, who were the people that were involved in starting our game up, and really go back and tell those stories because it's important not only for what's happening today, but for the future. We need to continue telling our stories. National Football Museum, fantastic idea.
Gives us a sense of permanence in the community, doesn't it? Final point, Spider, it wants to increase coaching and refereeing numbers, connect better with the Indigenous communities, and establish a national agenda for futsal and beach soccer. Personally, I've got no problem with any of that, but again, rather scant in terms of detail on how it's all going to be achieved.
Yeah, well, look, the coaching thing I think is a problem because the costs of being a coach and the mumbo jumbo that you've got to go through to get the licenses is a bit of a pain in the backside, to tell you the truth. Anyone who's been down that path will actually know what I'm talking about. But look, yeah, we have to have good coaches. We have to have good referees. I have heard that the referee numbers have gone down. We're the last country in the world should have numbers go down in referees, because this happens in Europe and overseas with the referees. I can understand referees running away from it, but it doesn't happen that much in Australia. I know people say, you know, the shouting from the sidelines and that, but it's not that bad. We're quite, how could I say, we're quite nice back home in Australia. So hopefully the numbers are up.
Waking up now.
We lost you a little bit.
You there, Simon?
Yeah, we've got you back, but
Sorry, mate.
You went all strange for a minute, which is
As I said, I just hope that the numbers go up in all departments, coaching and refereeing. That's it.
You know what I'd like to see also there, Simon? I don't think we mentioned school football enough in Australia. School football and also potentially university football, and other two areas where we know certainly in Asia. You know, the likes of Japan, the high schools and the university or the college football, plus we know what happens in the MLS in America. It's probably something that we don't speak about in Australia, but in terms of growth and growing our game, I think there are another two key areas where we can look to tap into.
Totally agree. Overall, the most glaring revelation for me was that Sport Australia High Performance Funding gives football just $3.4 million a year, while sports like basketball and field hockey get more than double than that. Not just ridiculous, but in my opinion, scandalous underfunding for the biggest participation sport in the country. Anything or anyone left out? There are four big absentees for me. I'll get your take on this, guys. Firstly, and most importantly, the fans. They get a cursory mention in Principle 8, to wit, engaging with fans to build trust and alignment, building fan forums and other platforms to encourage fan integration into club administration should be encouraged. I don't quite know what that means.
Me either.
No idea. But I would like to say that, you know, when is the penny going to drop in this country? This whole document, and lots of us spend an awful lot of time talking about players and coaches and administrators. We've got lots of people in all of those positions. Loads of players, loads of coaches, loads of administrators. What we don't have is enough fans paying their hard-earned to underpin the sport at professional level at least, and provide the income that's going to make these things reality that we talk about in the 11 principles. So I think that was disappointing. I'd have liked to have also seen attendance targets set for A-League and W-League clubs and a plan to increase eyeballs on television in the short term as well. But that was conspicuous by its absence for me. Secondly, stadiums. Plenty of talk about homes of football, but I think that leans more towards administrative homes and training bases. What about our own grounds? What about plans to play professional games in more appropriately sized venues, rather than cavernous homes like Suncorp or the rebuilt SFS? Thirdly, and you hinted to this.
It's a massive one.
Yeah, timelines. I don't think many would disagree with the arguments put forward in the principles, and even fewer would rail against the sport's desires. But when is all this going to happen? Too many of the timelines, woolly, non-existent, to be best summed up as at some point in the future, which is very similar to the whole football plan. And fourthly and crucially, who's paying for all this? Aside of the special purpose vehicle mentioned in connection with the commercialization of the game, vehicle is yet unknown, the elephant in the room, it remains money. How does the game generate the sorts of revenues It needs to implement expansion, more games, player developments, football museums, digital hubs. And for sure, government might be about to increase its investment on the back of the Women's World Cup, but that's only part of the answer. And for me, without a more commercially robust game, the 11 principles could well end up like the whole of football plan, which is basically Maori, just the latest in a long series of wish lists.
Yeah, and let's not forget the amount of money that people were paid to put the whole of football strategy in place. Who probably majority of them are no longer with us. This can't be another document that, again, dollars would have been invested, time, a lot of work. So we need to find the solutions and answers to make sure that this document comes to life, Simon. You touched on the fans in terms of one of your main points there that's been missed out. Fans play a massive, massive role. We know that, and they certainly we don't highlight that enough. You know, the Central Coast Mariners were talking about that, the fans trust and kind of, you know, a club model where fans engage and invest in a football club. Is that the way forward for our fans, for some of the clubs in Australia? You know, that might well work in Australia.
Spider, you go.
Yeah, look, I think it's I think Maury's right. It actually could work for certain clubs. Like, I don't know if it'll work for like the Sydney FCs, the Melbourne Victories. What's that?
Not the big clubs.
Yeah, but I think for the regional clubs, 100%. And the four other clubs that, if we're talking about getting the A-League up to 16 teams, those four clubs will actually play a big part in how the game looks as well if we get up to 16 teams in the competition. Mm-hmm. So, look, it's definitely one to look at, Maury. I don't mind the principles. They seem quite simple. But once again, like Simon said before, mate, let's make it happen. You know, let's stop doing all this talking. Let's make it happen. Like, you know, let's not just flush this down the toilet as well, and then 10 years down the track, we're talking about it again. There's been a lot of momentum since COVID. Let's really make it happen.
Yeah, and again, I can't stress the importance, because we know there's no money or, you know, that investment that we're talking about in Australia. We need to make tough decisions. When we're being told that up to $20 million is being wasted in administration, we need to look to make a decision to stop that happening. And that's $20 million that could be invested in the game.
Yeah. Okay, thanks, boys, for the moment. So the 11 principles, in my opinion, they're a good foundation for the game. We've long called for a plan. Now we've got the semblance of one. Now it's up to the game's leaders to turn it into practice from theory. That's their job. And as ever, if they don't, we'll hold them accountable, because that's us. Let's get into some other areas of discussion around the local game in Hard Talk.
Hard Talk.
Hard Talk is brought to you by StreamGate, which has been live streaming since 2008, specializing in custom-built stream pages, pay-per-view, and multi-language streaming. They can cater to large online conferences with multiple simultaneous streams and destinations, including all social media channels servicing clients Australia-wide. Go to streamgate.com.au or find them on Instagram. As ever, a big thanks to our sponsors. First big topic on Hard Talk today, the appointment of Tony Gustafsson as the new Matildas coach, announced at Australia House in London. He's well-credentialed. He's led the USA Women's National Team to two World Cups as assistant to Jill Ellis. But he's got big expectations in this job. Is he the right appointment, Maury and Spider?
I don't know the bloke, to be honest with you. I went through his CV. I've seen what he's done. Women's football, we all know, is not my strength. So it's not as if I go and have a look at too many results. I don't know. I'll be honest with you. The one thing I didn't like the push by the women to appoint him as coach. I didn't like that. But I'll give the guy a fair chance. And he's got a big job ahead of him, let me tell you.
It's a massive job. Look, he has a decent resume, Spider, and he's worked at a decent level. His involvement with the US Women's National Team, dealing with the creme de la creme, so to speak, in women's football. By all accounts, he's a straight shooter. And I know that there's Matilda contracts and that kind of thing with how it's structured at the moment. He just believes he's the type of coach that he doesn't want to be told who he can select them because they're on contracts. He wants to select the best group of girls. And that's something that I admire, because at the end of the day...
We like that, don't we?
Yeah. We like that. We like that a lot. There's a lot of expectation and there'll be a lot of pressure on this job. And Tony Gustafsson is coming in knowing exactly what those pressures are.
Also, Maury, great to see the FFA involving Socceroos and Matildas legends Lucas Neal and Alicia Ferguson-Cook to assist with the announcement. Lucas in particular, back in the fold after many years in exile. I know that you and the Golden Generation had a part to play in that.
Mate, well, thanks very much for mentioning that, Simon, because, mate, we played a massive part. We don't normally pump up our tyres enough, if I'm being honest. But myself and then leading on to the Golden Generation, that's the reason why FFA have got a contact with Lucas Neal now. So for me, it's great to see him involved and being able to help on that particular occasion for the FFA. Strong leadership. Simon will show that tapping into the Golden Generation is a strength, not a weakness. And I think the sooner we realise in Australia the value and the doors that we can open, we'll have a much better future.
It was a little bit disappointing to... I'm so glad to see Lucas back in the fold, but as Maury said, we already knew that because we'd spoken to him through the Golden Generation. Would have been nice from the FFA just to give someone else the accolades instead of trying to take the accolade themselves. And, mate, I'm not pumping Maury's tyres up, but Maury was behind it. Because I remember our first Zoom meeting when I seen Lucas and I said, "Oh, hello, my son." You know, like I hadn't seen him for so long.
Surprise, it was surprise.
Great to see him. Yeah, it was great. It was great to see him. The FFA could have just said, you know, we'd like to thank the Golden Generation for helping make this happen. But obviously, once again, they didn't. And they thought they'd try to take the glory for themselves, which is disappointing. All it needed was a thank you. That's it.
That's aside, boys, and I'm not sort of trying to belittle the point, but is this the start of something more formal between the game in Australia and Lucas? Is he going to be back involved on a more regular basis? Is he going to have an official role to play with perhaps the national teams as a mentor, an ambassador, something like that?
All those things, Simon, that you touch on are certainly possible now. The door has been opened for dialogue with Lucas. And I'm sure, you know, through some good discussion and some clear strategy, there's definitely a role for Lucas, especially around that kind of mentoring role that you mentioned. And that can be with the women, obviously can cross over with the men. Plus being on ground over here in the UK where a lot of our girls are playing as well. So, mate, hopefully bigger and better things to come. And great to see Lucas. And to be fair, he was looking a little bit swazzy in that suit, wasn't he? He was looking sharp.
He was looking sharp. What about the message I sent him? You're looking sharp, son. You've been MIA for a while, but you're looking sharp.
He was indeed. And obviously, he's got a sharp football mind, which we hope to utilise over the coming months and years. Maury, on a different topic, the A-League clubs and the PFA are, according to the Sydney Morning Herald on Friday, on the cusp of agreeing this long-awaited CBA deal. The salary cap, as we expected, will probably be slashed to $2.1 million. The season's still slated at the moment to start in December, but that at least is some good news.
Yeah, look, it is good. It's kind of the timing and all that sort of stuff has probably hindered, if I'm honest, a few players in Australia. This uncertainty around about the transfer window in particular in Europe, you know, for some players it's helped. For some it's kind of, you know, stopped any real serious conversations that they could have had. There has been a lot of uncertainty. So the quicker this can get done, and it's pleasing to hear that they are quite close. Simon, we know the drop in salary cap, as you mentioned, the $2.1 million. So will be tough for clubs, but hopefully we can get that sorted quickly.
Okay. In terms of where A-League players are going on the back of this salary cap being slashed, increasingly a lot of them heading over to the Indian Super League. Scott Neville and Dylan Fox rumoured to be the next two players on the plane to India. Robbie Fowler rumoured to be becoming the next coach of Bengal. Spider, are we seeing the rise of Indian football powered by money that is potentially going to rival China and the Chinese Super League in the next couple of years?
Look, I don't know if it's going to rival China, but if we recall what China did, we sadly in Australia can't compete with these countries with money. And the players, we all know how short their careers are. They sometimes do go to dungeons of places to play football, but to earn good money.
You do love that word, dungeon.
But there are some places like that. Like Bangladesh, we're getting players going to Bangladesh, guys, because the coin is too good. And with our salary cap, with the way it works, with our taxes in Australia, it's just impossible to compete with these countries. So as a player, are they making the right move for their career? Probably no. If they're going at the right age, like we've seen before, players go to Middle East and that at the back of their careers and fill their boots, so be it.
Okay, in terms of on-pitch action, Nikita Rukovic on target again from the penalty spot, but his Israeli team hammered 7-2 by Tottenham in the Europa League. The Champions League in Asia remains a competition, guys, in some disarray. The West Zone has almost completed its obligations. Congrats to Brad Jones's Al Nassr. They face Persepolis in the semi-finals. The East Zone, though, hasn't kicked a ball since Sydney drew with Jomboc all the way back on the 4th of March. And with these travel restrictions, more in and out of Australia, and quarantine rules in place for those who return, at what point do Australian clubs continue perhaps pulling the plug on this competition? Because it looks increasingly difficult to actually complete it in the East Zone.
Mate, it looks actually impossible, doesn't it? I mean, for the other side of the competition to be at semi-final stage and, you know, still so many games in the group stages to be completed on the Australian kind of group's side, mate, I don't know how it's possible. I think that the December 19 was when the final was booked in for. Hey, I can't see how that is possible to get played.
I love when you start thinking, buds. I see you start thinking, trying to go, how's this possible? I just don't know how they're going to do this.
Mate, but it's not. But unless what they do with the other groups that haven't completed their group rounds, unless they seed or kind of come up with some idea about who's one and two and have a quicker kind of scenario like they did in the Champions League at the last. That's the only way that it can come to a final that can be played this year. Otherwise, it's impossible.
The other problem, Spider, is that, again, that the later this competition is pushed back, and we're already in October now, they've still got, you know, four, in some cases, five group games to play before you even get to the knockout phase. If the A-League is going to start in December, how does that work, say, if Sydney or Melbourne Victory or Perth Glory were to get to the latter stage of the competition? It'd be impossible.
Yeah, no. You're spot on. And that's why I said when Maury speaks about it, when I start seeing his brain think, it just makes me laugh, because we as football people, we sit here and we think, what is going on? How are these clubs going to manage this? I agree with Maury. They're probably just going to have to go bang one-off matches and get it done with. But that means Perth Glory, it means Sydney FC have got to fly over there and actually play. Now, I don't even know if that's been set up yet for them to play. That's probably one to speak to those two clubs and say, what is going on, guys? Like, are you actually playing in this tournament or not? They're not letting anyone know either, are they?
Nah, and then to be fair, the Champions League actually costs Australian clubs money, a lot of money. You know, you're talking $300,000 or $400,000. Now, if the groups were seeded, for example, Australian teams wouldn't be in the top one or two seeds in those groups. Simon, would they?
No, not at the moment.
So there might be a way where you're kind of not pissing anybody off in terms of AFC and all that sort of stuff. A solution that they've found, and the Aussie clubs could save some money. That'd probably be a nice solution for them.
Well, Perth Glory won't be going then.
Mate. It's just with travel and that sort of stuff, I just can't see, and the restrictions and all those kind of things, I can't see it being played out.
It's going to be very, very difficult. I think the AFC obviously wants to get it played because it's got broadcast commitments, commercial commitments, and during the time of COVID, everybody is struggling for dollars. All right, thanks very much for the moment, guys. Let's head overseas. London calling.
London calling.
Well, let's start our overseas segment by, well, we've got to go to the Premier League, haven't we? Goodness me, what a weekend in the English Premier League. Liverpool beaten 7-2 by Aston Villa. Manchester United smashed 6-1 at home by Tottenham Hotspur, and Chelsea thumping Crystal Palace by 4-0. Man City couldn't win again. In the end of that weekend, the draw, I'm taking that at Elland Road, given what happened out there. What on earth is going on with football in the Premier League at the moment, guys?
Oh, Spy juicy.
I was watching Seville Barcelona. I got carried away with watching that game.
Was that a draw?
Which one?
That was a draw.
That was a draw. But mate, I can't believe that Liverpool lost 7-2. And I was thinking Solskjaer was going to get sacked morning, but maybe that result's taken the gloss off the other result. So maybe they'll say it's just a COVID thing. We'll just keep going the way it is. I just can't believe what's happening in world football at the moment. Like, the Premier League's gone bananas. But all over Europe, there's goals flying left and centre.
Everton, the last time they won 4 top flight games, the first 4 was in 1969, Simon. They actually won the league that year. They've got off to an amazing start. Calvert-Lewin scoring goals every week, every game. James Rodriguez, massive for Everton since he's come in. Leicester took an absolute surprise battering by West Ham. The Liverpool game was incredible. Aston Villa could have scored 10. Ollie Watkins got 3, could have scored 5. Grealish could have got a hat-trick. Barkley could have got a hat-trick. The high line spikes. Liverpool played the high line, but they didn't have pressure on the ball. So Aston Villa were getting in behind them, mate, for fun. Man United getting tonked 6-1 at home. Oh, my God. There was an incident in this game between Lamella and Martial there, where Martial got sent off.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And if the referee is going to send Martial off, he's got to send Lamella off. He's conned the referee. It was handbag spides. Ended up, Martial got sent off. Straight after that, Man United got caught trying to play out from the back, conceded a third, and it just went from bad to worse for him.
Yeah, it's strange. It seems to me that Solskjaer, with the way they finished last season, everyone was saying, yeah, it's turning. And now the season's restarted and they've gone back to playing crap, really. And for a club the size of them, like what I've heard from Man United supporters is their recruiting's been poor. And even Rooney came out the other day and said they should have actually spent their money going after someone like, you know, Kane. Yeah.
Yeah, it seems as if they've not had a plan. I mean, now that you talk Edison Cavani coming in, but he's never been on the radar, and there's no way that he could have been on the radar and kept a player of that stature in the game quiet. So the feeling here in the UK is that they're off the cuff.
Yeah. They look like that, don't they, Maury? I would have loved to see Roy Keane on one of the TV shows this week, and that would have been gold.
Spider, I just want to ask you about Liverpool and that's results at Villa Park. Of course, they were without Alisson, their first-choice goalkeeper. His replacement, Adrian, has never really convinced between the posts. How important is Alisson to the way Liverpool play? Maury mentioned that high defensive line. How much is he going to be missed over the next 4 to 6 weeks, which he's due to be out for?
Yeah, look, I think we all know how important a good goalkeeper is. He made the difference. He came in and Liverpool all of a sudden, won Champions League, won titles. He's a fantastic goalkeeper. And what happens when you have someone like that in goals, the team's more confident. And I don't say Adrian's a poor goalkeeper. It's just the way it pans out. Some keepers just unlucky when they go in behind someone as good as Alisson. Now, Liverpool, for me, all pre-season, they played a high line, Simon. They were playing risky football all season. We all know the Premier League is smart managers, very good players. Someone's going to work you out. Did we think it was going to be Aston Villa? No. But I'm sure Klopp won't panic. I'm sure they have a lot to say to him, but I'm sure they'll bounce back. In football, in these times, Maury, yeah, we're going to see a lot of results like this.
No, because how much of a factor is the no fans in the stadium actually playing?
Massive. We spoke about it last week, 2 weeks ago. It's huge, huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, you go to Liverpool, or you go to at Villa Park, there's no supporters now. It's these big players thrive on getting abuse. They love it. And they want to show the opposition fans and they want to shut them up and they perform. Now, I'm not saying they're not trying 100% Maury, but it is a big difference when there's no one there.
No, it's a massive one. And Adrian Simon that come in for this game, he cops 7. But the first goal was a mistake from Adrian, trying to overplay from the back. A bad pass ends up coming back into Ollie Watkins, who scored. So confidence-wise, with your goalkeeper coming in and making a mistake from the very beginning and being without Alisson for 4 to 6 weeks, I tell you what, that could be a really, really big moment for potentially what Liverpool can or can't do this season.
Yeah, but the other teams are stuttering at the moment as well, Maury. I think it's going to be a real strange season this year, the Premier League.
Mate, we're back to the 80s. We've got Everton and Aston Villa on top of the league.
Go on, Ancelotti.
Everton, last champions of England, 1985, I think it was, wasn't it? Anyway.
Oh, was it? I've seen a stat this week, Simon, that the first time they won the top four games in the top division was in 1969, and they won the league that year.
69-70, yeah. I was just trying to think the last time they won the league. Anyway, I know Aston Villa last won it in 1981 because they were European champions the next year. Talking of Liverpool, this story sort of caught my eye. Young striker, no doubt he's got lots of potential. Ryan Brewster is very highly rated at Liverpool. He's not played a single minute in the Premier League. Sheffield United have just signed for £23.5 million. And this is in the week when clubs like Macclesfield Town have gone under and there's still no official agreement between the Premier League clubs and the English Football League clubs and even lower down the scale to help them out. This really is an indication of just how big the gap is between the two. They just operate on different levels, don't they?
Massively, massively. And that's, you know, 23 million, you mentioned, that's not chumps change. And Sheffield United, look, they're yet to get a point in the Premier League this year. So it's strange that he's not had some kind of involvement. A lot of things being spoken about here, Simon, in terms of the EFL, the League Ones and the League Twos, and you've also written a story, I believe, recently. But there's talk of the support from government, which we would never get in Australia, let's be honest. But also the Premier League clubs, you know, in terms of the parachute payment that teams get when they're relegated. Yeah. They're talking about, you know, if they can try and find a solution to help the lower division clubs with this parachute kind of money, and that hopefully could save clubs because we're talking hundred odd years of history. That's something that has to be protected, and there's a big push here in the UK, and hopefully they can come up with the right answers.
I hope so. Just finally on this segment, Spider, we've seen a Champions League draw this week. Champions Bayern in with Atletico Madrid, Salzburg, Lokomotiv Moscow. Aumabil, of course, is going to play in the Champions League for Midtjylland, and he's got some interesting opposition. Liverpool, Ajax and Atalanta. That's a tough group, that one.
What a great group for him.
Yeah, brilliant experience for him. Group G, Juve, Barca, Dinamo Kiev and Ferencvaros. Group H is the group of death for me. Paris Saint-Germain, Manchester United, RB Leipzig and Basaksehir, the Turkish club that are cashed up as well. And James Holland, of course, is in the Europa League as well. They've qualified, Maury, with LASK, a competition he did so well in last year.
Yep. And Dejanek also, I believe, with Red Star, qualified for Europa. So yeah, it's good to see some Aussies that are going to be experiencing, you know, football at the highest level and playing the European Knights, mate. I mean, Spider, you've played them as well. They're amazing. They're amazing Knights. They really get the hairs on the back of your neck standing up. You get the opportunity to test yourself against the best. So, look, great to see some Aussie boys that are going to experience that. Awa Mabil, what a story. He was in tears after their game where they qualified. What an opportunity. What a group his is. It's a really exciting group.
Sure is.
Yeah, if you're going to go out, Maury, you might as well go out to those teams.
You're not giving much hope then, Spider.
Well, you know, the beauty is, Simon, when we get him on the show, we can ask him his favourite stadium. He might have one of those three to tell us.
All right.
Whose jersey did you get?
Thanks, boys, for the moment. Let's move on to our final segment for today. And for Footballers Lives, we have one of Australia's all-time greats.
Footballers Lives.
Well, our guest today was born in Adelaide in 1976, and he made his debut for Adelaide City as a teenager before almost immediately heading overseas to join Standard Liège in Belgium. He established himself in Europe at Antwerp and then joined Cremonese in Italy. He then went to England with Portsmouth and Coventry before completing his tour of the big leagues in Spain with Osasuna and Alaves before returning home in 2007 to play out his days in the A-League with the Central Coast Mariners, Sydney FC, and finally Melbourne Heart. He won 55 caps for the Socceroos, scoring 27 goals, and of course became famous for scoring that penalty that took the national team to the first World Cup in 32 years. He's since enjoyed stints as head coach at Melbourne Heart and Brisbane Roar, and these days he works for Optus Sport as a TV pundit and commentator, although I think somehow it won't be too long before we see him back in the technical zone. It is a great pleasure to welcome to the podcast the great John Aloisi. How are you, Johnny? John
Aloisi.
Yeah, good. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. I've been listening and I've been enjoying the podcast so far, so it's a pleasure to be on.
Great to have you. Johnny, take us back to those early days in Adelaide as a kid and growing up with your brother, Ross. You obviously came from a big football family, Italian heritage. Was it always in your blood and always your dream?
It was in our blood because my dad, he played a bit, but he mainly coached. So we can only remember him coaching and coaching us as kids and in the backyard with my brother playing. But we played a lot of different sports. We're mainly cricket in the summer and in the winter was football, soccer. And we used to go support our local team, which was Adelaide City, which was of Italian heritage as well. And we used to spend our days and hours there, weekends there, and that was really our second home. So it was. I enjoyed my upbringing. I enjoyed playing sport, and probably having an older brother pushed me a lot as well. So you know, it was great to have Ross as a sort of a, I wouldn't say a mentor, but you know, someone that you could kick the ball around with.
Do you remember your debut for Adelaide City? I think you were only, was it 15?
15, yeah. I was 15
your only
years
game
old.
For them?
Yeah, it was my only game because then I ended up going to the Institute of Sport for a little bit there with Maury. We had Dukes, Skokes. We had a pretty good group. And then from there, I went overseas. But I remember my debut because it was against Melbourne Knights, Melbourne Croatia back then. And I came on as a sub with about 15 minutes to go and caused a little bit of a riot. It was I ended up getting tackled by a player called Mark Talaich, and I fell to the ground and he sort of pushed my face down in the ground and, you know, there was a bit of a scuffle and,
welcome,
and
all young of a sudden, boy.
What's that?
Welcome, young boy.
Yeah, welcome, young boy, which, you know, you expect that from an older pro, but the Italians didn't fence and hit front page of the paper, but not my debut, the fight that was going to happen.
How did that move overseas come about, John?
It came about, I was playing with a Serbian player at Adelaide City and he was saying to me, he goes, your best bet is to go overseas now and try and make it at an early age because that's a foot in the door. They will take a punt on a younger player. And so he set me up with an agent that took me over to Belgium. I went on a two-week trial with Standard Liège and then they wanted to sign me. So that's how it came about. It was a rude shock because it was winter there and it was -7 degrees when I first went over there, and I was like, never been as cold in my life before. But it was something that was a dream to play in Europe.
You sort of struggled to establish yourself a bit in Belgium, but I know that you became the youngest foreigner ever to score in Serie A with Cremonese. That must have been a fantastic experience.
Yeah, that was a good experience, especially, you know, that growing up watching Serie A on Sunday mornings, you know, watching the best players in the world. And back then, they were the best players. You only allowed 3 foreigners back then, and the Italians seemed to spend all their money on those foreign players. So to play against the likes of AC Milan and Juventus and Inter Milan and playing at the San Siro was special. But playing in a team that's struggling in Italy is not that nice, because back then it was very defensive, and being a striker, you didn't get many chances.
Run the channel, son. Run the channel.
it was horrible, and every training session was done on defensive tactics, and I'm going, any danger of us touching a ball here? So it was a different experience, put it that way. I didn't enjoy my football as much in Italy as I did elsewhere.
Johnny, you mentioned you went at a young age, and the challenges for young players going overseas. You touched on the weather, so something you probably hadn't experienced, but also in terms of foreign countries and language. So talk us through that experience.
Yeah, that was hard, Maury, because I went to Liège first, and that's French-speaking in Belgium, and I couldn't speak a word of French. So, and what it's like, you know what it's like. All the Aussies that go over there know that you have to really fight for your spot, because they sort of look down on you, because, you know, you're Australian. You shouldn't be taking one of the local players' spots. So you really had to fight, and you had a, you know, we talk about language barriers and the weather, but it's also missing home, missing your family, going through that. Who do you turn to when things aren't going well? You've got no one really to turn to. You have to get through it yourself, and that also makes you, I think, that makes you that much stronger mentally, and it hardens you up very early.
Johnny, do you reckon the 2-footed tackles Roscoe put on you in the backyard hardened you up?
You know what, Spider? He put a few 2-footed tackles on me. We used to, like, every game that we played, whether it was football, whether it was cricket, whether it was table tennis or just snooker, it would end up in a fight. And he stopped trying to fight me when I got a bit bigger than him.
And he was preparing you for European football, but...
It's true. But you know what, Scotty, you say that, and you're, it's funny, we're joking around about it, but it is true. It does prepare you, because over there, you know, in training, some of the tackles that used to fly about, because people are desperate to play. They're playing for their future. They're playing for their spot. And if you can't deal with it, you're not going to last. And so that did help me quite a bit. But also playing in the local NPL State League back then, you know, we played against some hard players growing up, so that held me in good stead as well.
Johnny, probably one of the things that Australia couldn't prepare you for, at least at senior level, was being relegated. And unfortunately for you, that seemed to become a bit of a feature of, I'm not wishing to sound unkind, but it was a feature of your club career. You got relegated twice with Cremonese. I think you got relegated with Coventry City, and you also got relegated, I think I'm right in saying, with Alaves as well in your final season in Spain. They must be very difficult things to deal with. I know Spider and Maury, you know, you played for clubs that were challenging for trophies at the top end of your particular leagues. But for you, fighting against that drop, how tough is that mentally, and how big an impact does relegation have, not just on the club, but on players?
Yeah, mentally it's very tough. At first in Italy, I didn't know how to handle it well. I was only young, of course, so it wasn't pretty, but it was also hard on the whole city, because you think about when you're playing Serie A and you're getting Juventus coming to town, or, you know, AC Milan or Inter Milan, it's great for the economy, because they're bringing thousands of fans. So when you're talking about getting relegated, it's not just the club, it's the whole actual city that suffer. and the players, of course. So it's not a great experience, but they did hold me in good stead for future relegation battles, because you say, and I did get relegated four times, but that's over a 20-year period, Tom. So there was also your moments. You fought relegation and you survived, and that was just as important as winning a trophy. And because, you know, it was like a party in the city and at the club. And with Osasuna, which were a team that were normally going to fight relegation, we seemed to survive every time in the 4 years that I was there. And it was important for not only the team, but for the whole city.
I want to ask you about the cup final for Osasuna in a moment. But before that, just a brief recollection on your time in England with Coventry, of course, but also with Portsmouth, where you were part of a little sort of Australian colony, all thanks to Terry Venables, really. How much of an influence was he on your career?
Yeah, I started playing in the national team because of Terry Venables. He selected me for the first time. I thought that he was a great manager. Tactically, he was the first manager that really taught us tactically, that had that, you know, that way of putting it that just made it simple for us, that we understood exactly what our roles were. And he was a great man manager. And yeah, he brought not only myself, but Spider was supposed to play there, but he couldn't get the work permit. It would have been great to play with Spider. But all went a bit pear-shaped when Terry left, because, you know, we were left there and they didn't want us Australians still there. But I stayed on for a little bit and ended up having a pretty good year that ended up getting sold to Coventry City in the Premier League.
Johnny, talk us about that, because you've told me that story before. So who was the coach that come in after that?
So we had Terry Fenwick, who was the coach. And then when Terry Venables left, he left. And Alan Ball came in. And Alan Ball straight away just sat me down and said, I don't want you here. I don't want any of the Australians here. And he was pretty blunt about it. But I had nowhere to go because I hadn't really played unbelievably well, that I had, you know, clubs lining up. So I just had to fight my spot. And at first, I wasn't even in the squad. And then started to make the bench. And then, you know, when I was on the bench and I'd come in, I'd do my best to score a goal. And then, you start to win your spot back. And in the end, he had no choice but to play me. And then ended up going on a pretty good run.
Did you have a similar situation with Gordon Strachan?
Yeah. With Gordon Strachan, look, I could understand Gordon Strachan a little bit too, because you know how hard it was when we used to go with our national team, with the Socceroos, yeah. And we used to miss out, and he wasn't happy that I went away on a 5-week...
Like Vanuatu.
It was Coffs Harbour. Do you remember the Coffs Harbour trip?
Oh, do I what? What a trip.
Yeah, but anyway, I ended up bloody tearing my hamstring and I was out for bloody 2 months after that trip. So I tore it in the last game. I think it was against Fiji, mind you. And so he was not happy at all. And when I got back, he said that, you know, again, I can't have this anymore and, you know, look for another club. But I started to work my way back in and started to play again.
I want to ask you one question, John, about your relegation season with Coventry in 2001. You're quite sort of renowned in Australia as being, you know, very mild-mannered. You have your occasional life on the sidelines, but you're a very controlled person. You got sent off for punching Danny Mills in a game against Charlton. What happened there?
I wouldn't call that a punch, Simon. If you see the footage, it is a weak punch. It's a slap, and I'm embarrassed that I actually didn't punch him.
It's more, you would say, handbags.
Yeah. I would have loved to have punched him properly and got sent off for a good reason. he was kicking me all game, Simon, and I just I lost it. And you know, every time that you know, you look back and you look at it and you go, well, you know, sure to control your temper a little bit better, but yeah, I ended up getting three games for that sending off.
In terms of your move to Spain, you went to Osasuna, and that's where you played the most games in your career, 121 appearances, 29 goals, which included a cup final appearance, and you scored in that game as well. Is that where you were the happiest during your playing career with Osasuna?
Yeah, definitely the happiest. I think that that's where I felt at home. I felt like it was a family club. But also like the players and not only the players that I played with, but playing against, it was a really good league. And it was a mix between Italy and England at the time, whereas England was great to play in front of the crowds and that, but it was very open. And probably the tactical side wasn't there that much back then. But in Spain, the tactics were there, but they also gave you that little bit of freedom. Whereas in Italy, it was the other way around. It was just all tactical. So it was a good mixture, and I enjoyed my football the most in Spain.
Johnny, before we start talking about your time when you returned back to Australia, I know that you were recently back at Osasuna, and you got a fantastic reception from the supporters there. And how did that make you feel? You know, like it's a club that you've really enjoyed. You had some great times, but the respect that they have for players that have done the business for the club.
I was shocked, Maury, to be honest, because I hadn't been back there for 15 years. And then to go back there and be received like that, it was humbling. It was a great experience. A lot of them remember because of the cup final, I scored the goal and I equalised right near the end against Real Betis. We ended up losing an extra time, but that's the only cup final that Osasuna has been to in their 100-year history. Wow. And so it means a lot to them. And not only in the stadium, I was just walking down the street in the city, and you know, people were stopping me and wanting to talk about the cup final, my time at Osasuna, and but that's football. That's their life. That's what they just love it, and they remember their ex players, and they respect their ex players as well,
which is terrific. Johnny, let's just talk briefly about your playing days back here in Australia. It's sort of a bit of a mixed bag, I guess, to round out your career. You finally got to play in a grand final for the Mariners, but you lost. You won the premiership with Sydney FC, scored a wonderful goal to clinch that trophy against Melbourne Victory, but missed out on the grand final due to injury. You had a difficult relationship with the fans with Sydney FC, it's probably fair to say. And then you end up with Melbourne Heart, and you score in the first ever Melbourne derby. Just pick out some of the highs and lows of your final few years as a player with those clubs.
Oh, definitely a high was, you know, win the Premier's Plate with both Central Coast Mariners and with Sydney FC. And you know, there were definitely the low was the injury that I had just before I went to Sydney FC, and then during that period at Sydney, I had a bad knee injury. And I thought that I was going to be able to get back to what I was before, prior to the injury, but I just couldn't. Like my knee was just, it wasn't strong enough, and I didn't have the same. Your mind's there, and you know where you want to be, but you just, your body's not following. And it took a while to just get back to a certain level in my second season at Sydney, which was good because I was able to contribute to winning that Premier's Plate and score. I think I was leading goal scorer of the team that year. But it was tough going because I didn't enjoy actually training anymore because I couldn't do what I was able to do before the injury.
You had to, as I say, a bit of a difficult relationship with the fans because you'd come in on marquee money and a lot was expected of you. Did you feel as though those expectations were unfair given the fact that you were carrying that injury as well?
Yeah, but players, Simon, don't, I mean, not players, the fans don't care about injuries. They don't care about, you know, and nor should they. Like, once you set foot onto that pitch, you're there to perform. And so I understood that. I get it. I understand why they were, you know, expecting more of me. You know, in the end, they actually turned and they supported me when, you know, I was scoring goals towards the end of the season to win the Premier's Plate. So, you know, it's supporters, you know, they want to see their team win. They want to see their players perform. And you just have to accept that. Sometimes you get a little bit upset when the club doesn't protect you a little bit more because, you know, they're there to do that for you as well. As a player or whatever your involvement is in with the club. And I don't believe Sydney FC at the time did really protect individuals.
In terms of your coaching career, you took your first steps with Melbourne Hearts and then, of course, you subsequently coached Brisbane. Did that first coaching job come... Were you ready for it, do you think, at that point? Or by the time you went to Brisbane, were you more experienced and more able to deal with that coaching role, do you think?
You're never ready to be the head coach. You get through, no matter how much if you've been an assistant for years or if you've been, because you can't prepare for what's, going to be thrown at you. But I would say that, I know the results weren't there with Melbourne Heart, but that was invaluable, the experience that I had at Melbourne Heart. I learned so much, and it's not about the tactical side, because the tactical side, you know enough about even the man management with the players, you know enough about. It's more dealing with, the board, the media, the surroundings that come with being a head coach. And I had no idea that, the club at the time wanted to sell. So there was it was a massive cut in the football budget. And so, I didn't know how to really handle that until the experience that I had. And that set me up for Brisbane Roar, because when I stepped into Brisbane Roar, it was a disaster. The players hadn't been paid their super for over a year. We've been kicked out of a training ground many a times. And again, it's still happening with Brisbane Roar. They just got kicked out recently. So that prepared me, Simon, that experience I had at Melbourne Heart. And so went into the Brisbane Roar, I knew what to expect and how to handle it. And we were unfortunate we didn't win the Premier's Plate that year, because we drew in the last game. If we'd won, we would have won the title.
That was against Victory, wasn't it, John?
Yeah, against Victory. Matty Mackay missed the sitter. I still talk to him about that.
Two or 3 minutes in it was as well. Yeah, an early goal would have been.
And then that 5-4 game spider against Western Sydney Wanderers.
What a way to finish football at the old Parramatta Stadium. Seriously, I know it went on the wrong side for you guys, but that stadium brought so many memories for that club, Western Sydney Wanderers, and what a game it was. I never forget it as well. Like, full house. We were 3-0 down. Like, seriously, we were attacking. Every time you just went up, goal. It was like 3-0 down after 27 minutes in a semi-final. It was just an incredible game of football.
Yeah. The atmosphere, look, we've played in many of stadiums around the world. I can't recall an atmosphere like that. That night there, You could just feel like when there was a goal scored, like when it went to 3-1, that just the crowd picked up and just lifted your team. And we ended up going, buddy, 4-3 down, and to equalise to make it 4-4, go into extra time. I still think, and a lot of people have brought that up, not just that game, but that season, that was probably the peak of the A-League that season. And you're talking about the football being played, the way that it was played, and also the crowds that we were getting. It was a good year that year.
Johnny, yeah, it was unbelievable.
Johnny, the early days at Melbourne Heart, I think what a lot of people actually forget, especially in a salary-capped league, the club sold three or four of your brightest, youngest players. I think it was Curtis Good, you had Hamill.
Aziz Baich.
But these players were all on, obviously, low wages. But first team players, it's virtually impossible to replace that quality at that figure.
No, the only way you could replace them is bringing young players in again, but they're not ready. And so I brought in Stefan Mork, I brought in Ben Garuccio, and these players that were going to become very good players, very good professionals, but they weren't quite ready. But that's where the club, and this is where I soon realised, because I didn't want to come out and make excuses, because you're a coach, you can't be making excuses. But the club should be transparent with the supporters, with the media, and say, look, we're going to go through a bit of a transitional period because we just lost Curtis Good, Brendan Hammer was Aziz Baich, literally a few weeks before the season started. Yeah. they're some of our main players. Then I brought in Redmayne, that hadn't really played regular football until that stage. So he's still learning his trade. These young players are going to take time. And without a relegation league, you should be able to give them that time. But obviously, I didn't get the time.
Two more questions, Johnny, before we move on to some Twitter questions from our listeners. First of all, with Brisbane, was that Champions League game against Ceres Negros, was that your worst night in football? It might have been Maury's as well.
That was my fault.
Both of you. And then we'll ask you about the World Cup in Germany. But first of all, that game at Nathan, which I called along with Ned Zelic, one of the most surreal nights, I think.
So you know what, Simon? It all came out, and it was not great. Of course, it wasn't great, and it was embarrassing for a lot of people. But that's what we'd have been dealing with through ever since we're at Brisbane Roar, because the little things. So the kit man at the time who was doing the shirts, he'd get that overworked that he virtually hadn't slept for, you know, weeks on end, and he you know made mistakes and whatever else. But that's because the club was taking shortcuts in too many things. And yes, we're the face of it, so it looks like it's our fault, but it's an issue, and it has been an issue for a long period with not just one club, but many clubs in the A-League. And sometimes it needs to come out like that so people realise, well, what are we doing? Are we really a professional setup, or we're just a part of a professional league that's run like, on an oily rag, which we were running on an oily rag, believe me.
I was still looking when Chris Fong absolutely belted me saying it was my fault. Man, I was trying to look through my job description, mate, and I couldn't see like where it said, you know, I had to press numbers and names on jersey.
What about me? I'm trying to get the result and I'm turning around and we can't get Eric Boatiak on because his number's coming off. Then we're trying to stick it back on and I'm going, seriously, this is not happening, is it?
Can I tell you, John, a quick funny story? Because I was in commentary that night along with Ned Zelich, and I remember coming out to the ground afterwards and I was fuming on behalf of the A-League. You know, I thought this is a really bad look for our league across Asia, especially playing in that stadium, which was, you know, 50,000. There must have been, what, 500 people inside it.
Yeah.
And as I walked out, Ned Zelich, who was in co-commentary, followed behind me. And all I could hear was him just laughing, just absolutely guffawing in the background. And I turned around and I said, what are you laughing at? And Ned said, you know, his own inimitable style. It's just one of those nights, you know, that you'll always be able to say, I was there when this happened. I'm not very funny for you.
That's exactly what he would have said.
Don't worry. I remember like sitting in the car park with Maureen going, what the hell just happened there? And, and this is that was a contrast from just a few months earlier, the year before we ended up qualifying against Shanghai Shenhua in China, and Tevez made his appearance and he was on $52 million a year. But the result on the pitch and the performance on the pitch was a lot better that night, but the club was still the same. It hadn't changed. We were trying to make changes, but it was just getting very, very hard.
Okay, Johnny, we have to sort of wrap this up very shortly, but a couple more questions about the international scene. We got a couple of Twitter questions. Obviously, you're famous for this goal that you scored against Uruguay. Nick Ogle on Facebook asks, I would love to know if John ever thought he was going to miss that penalty that got us the World Cup, or was he 100% confident you were going to score it?
Oh, please. What a question that is.
Lucky I was confident, because if I wasn't, I would have missed. I didn't think twice, Simon. It was one of those moments that I actually dreamt about, but I also practiced the day before down that end against Ante Kovic. Not against Spider, because he might have saved a couple and I would have lost my confidence.
Lee Broxham Facts also asked, if you drew a graph on how many people still love to ask you about 2005 every year since then, what does that graph look like? Is it steady? Is it increasing or decreasing?
You know, it increases because the more that, because there's a generation that don't remember it. And then, you know, if they're with their parents or whatever else, that they will bring it up. So, and now with, you know, you can just get it on your phone and they'll show it. And it's amazing. I think I've met 150,000 people that were at the stadium. Now, I only held 83,000.
And this one, Johnny, on a slightly different topic from Theoclitopoulos, I've got to pronounce this correctly, Theoclitopoulos. And it's our question.
I reckon he's a Greek.
I reckon he's. It's our question of the week. Congratulations, $100 meal voucher from Outback coming your way. Why do you think there's so many less star players, and that's a matter of opinion, of course, being developed now as opposed to when the golden generation came through, despite the NSL only being semi-pro? Interesting question.
How much time have we got, Simon?
Try and make it quick if you can, Johnny.
Oh, look, there's many things that we could bring up and talk about that. It's a difficult one to put your finger on because, you know, back then I still believe that the Institute of Sport made a big difference, but also the clubs. I know they were only semi-pro, but, you know, I know that Spider's dream would have been playing for Sydney Croatia. My dream was playing for Adelaide City. It meant everything to us, and that's all you were doing when you were playing at the junior level was making sure that you're going to get to the senior level, and I think that just mentally we spoke about before we had to be tough because what we went through as kids.
Last one, Johnny, and this is my own question. For all you get the adulation for scoring that penalty against Uruguay, of course, people sometimes forget that you're one of only five Australian men to score at both the World Cup finals and an Asian Cup finals. That goal against Japan, the third goal, was that the highlight or one of the big highlights of your career as well, to actually go to a World Cup and score on that stage?
Definitely. To go to a World Cup, because we had all dreamt of it and we hadn't, you know, it was so many times of trying. I think I was in two campaigns before that. Spider would have been in more. Maury was in the same as me. We just didn't know we were going to get there. And then finally to get there, and it you know, I was lucky enough to score the goal, you know, in that game against Japan. But it was the way we won, the way we came from behind, and because it was our first win, that was our World Cup final. If we didn't win that game, we were never going to get through the group. So to win that was definitely a highlight.
Johnny, you also were robbed of a goal in that World Cup against Croatia. Graham Paul, he didn't have
Graham
a great
Paul,
night.
Nah, that was his last game that he ever that he refereed, and so it should be. I went up to him, Maury, as I was hitting the ball, he blew the final whistle, and obviously the whistle went before it hit the back of the net. And I went to him, what happened? Why did you whistle for? He goes, don't worry, you're through anyway. And I'm like, we would have won the game, and I would have scored another goal at the World Cup. What do you mean, don't worry?
Yeah.
I was gutted that I didn't get another goal to my name as well. That's been that selfish striker, Spider.
Hey, Johnny, tell us, mate, you're one of the players who have played at some unbelievable stadiums around the world, mate. What's your favourite stadium you've played at?
The Bernabeu and the San Siro. I think the San Siro, like the dressing rooms and the away dressing room, Spider, you would have been in there. It's not big, it's tiny. Yeah. But just when you walk out there, you know, just like the stand just goes up. It's so steep. It feels like they're on top of you. And just the size of it and the history with the San Siro as well. But the Bernabeu is impressive as well. It's similar. And just knowing the history of Real Madrid, it's one of the best stadiums that I've ever been in.
Johnny, we could talk for hours about your career, about football in general, but time has beaten us, unfortunately. All we can say is thanks once again, mate, for joining us. Brilliant to hear some of your stories. Thanks, mate.
Thanks for having me on. And get
cheers, Jay.
Spider and Maury, I don't know if you're going to fall back asleep, Spider, or you have to get up and go to work.
Nah, Popovich has got the whip out, son.
Thanks, Johnny.
And, thanks for having me.
That is us for this week. We'll be back same time, same place next week. Until then, enjoy your football and bye for now.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.